Blog Talk Radio.
Graham Hancock. You're listening to Earth Ancients with Cliff Dunning.
And a good morning to you, wherever you're at around the world. This is Earth Ancients. This is Cliff. And hello. Hello, hello, hello. a little too much coffee here. Hope you're doing well. Tons of interesting stuff in the news. Today is our focus is on the Great Pyramid. And it's so odd that the topic of the Great Pyramid and the Giza Plateau there's a prelude to this, and the prelude is that I have been getting photos taken as far back as like 30 years ago of the Giza Plateau, the Great Sphinx, various digs, and I've been posting them on my Facebook page, Facebook Earth Ancients. You can go to groups and you'll see them. But what happened, what I got about 24 hours ago was some leaked photos of the interior of the Sphinx. And when I say leaked, it's weird because no one's ever seen them before. And a couple of the photos actually show Zahi Hawass, the at one time the Supreme Antiquities director of the entire plateau, climbing into a chamber just in front of the Sphinx itself. No one has ever seen these photos. No one's ever had an idea what they're about. But one Spanish article that I actually posted that you can actually translate on your when you're looking at it, talks about this interior chamber within the Sphinx. Now, why have we not heard about this before? The article goes into great detail about they were worried about the Sphinx because it was deteriorating to a degree where portions of the outer walls were collapsing. And this image very clearly shows workers fixing the roof and sides of the interior. And as you look down this tunnel, this room that leads to a tunnel, there's an open space. Now, we don't know if this space is the front or the back of the Sphinx, but I've spent the majority of this week posting photographs that people have sent me and some of the other ones that have been leaked by French and Spanish, I guess, tourists who have been over there of the Sphinx. And it's just amazing that we have not been told or information hasn't been released about these interior chambers. Now, I can see why they might be quiet about, who cares about the damage of the outer walls of the Sphinx. I personally think it's fascinating. It probably would be something that the National Geographic would pick up, but it's a little disturbing when you see this level of depth that I've revealed in these leaked photographs, people climbing into the top of the Sphinx. I mean, it seems like there's about four or five different entrance ways into interior chambers, into openings that lead to underground canals that pass underneath the Sphinx. And it's just, it kind of bothers me. It's kind of irritating that the general public just doesn't get anything from the researchers, the people who are supposed to be in charge of these great monuments. And the only way we can get them is through leaked photographs. And so it's very, 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 very bothersome to me. And I personally have never really trusted Zahi Hawass. Graham Hancock tried to have a debate with him about a year or two ago, and he just shows tremendous ignorance, tremendous narcissism. It's him or no, it's his way or no way or the door or whatever. And I find that it's sad that we are held hostage by these third world types of individuals like this. And I would think, and I don't know this for a fact, but Egypt, one of their main economies is tourism. It runs into the billions of dollars. And why they aren't more forthwith with this information is just beyond me. So we're left to having, photographs leaked by either one-time researchers or people who were given permission to travel within the interior of the Great Sphinx and parts of the Giza Plateau, be it the pyramids, or we've had and posted photos of these monstrous water canals that are underneath the whole Giza pyramid plateau. It's huge. So anyhow, it's been kind of fun, but it's also, when I think about it, it's like, God, I would have loved to have known about this years ago. And I think the people that have been researching that area, Dr. Robert Schock as one, John Anthony West, Robert Bouval, who spent a tremendous amount of time and has written a lot of material on the Sphinx, probably would have loved to be able to see the interior of these and report on them. So we could have known about it 20 plus years ago. And it's also highly suspicious to me, because I have a feeling, and we'll hear about it today with our guest, who reveals quite a bit about not only the Sphinx, but the Great Pyramid, there's been a knowledge of the underground canals for decades. And there's been knowledge of the Sphinx and its connection to the Great Pyramid for decades. Today is a little bit of an eye-opener because you're going to hear, this was pre, by the way, today's interview was recorded yesterday because our guest is in the Netherlands. But he discovered that, and you're going to hear details, that the Sphinx is part of a general piece of machinery, and it's directly linked, this machinery that is underneath and part of the Sphinx is linked to the Great Pyramid. Why hasn't it been revealed to us before? So I'm not going to go over this too much, but you'll hear it in today's interview. So check out the photo display that I have on the Facebook Earth Ancient website. There's probably, 6 photos. The most recent one, the one I posted this morning, is the interior of the Great Sphinx. Pretty amazing stuff. And we're going to introduce today's guest in just a second. I want to mention a couple of other things. I'm doing a giveaway on Facebook. I got an extra couple of copies of Magician of the Gods, which is Graham Hancock's newest book, and I'm doing a raffle. And I'm going to give away both of these books. And what you need to do is, if you go – actually, you don't even have to go on the website. If you want a copy and you want to join the raffle, send me an email to Cliff, at earthancients.com. Pick a number between 1 and 1,000 and then email it to me with your name and your address. I wrote down a number. I put it in an envelope a few days ago. And by the way, this raffle is going to go on for 10 days. And throw a number together, and if you have the right number, or if it comes close to the right number between 1 and 1,000, you'll get a free copy of Magician of the Gods. This is Graham Hancock's new bestseller. I mean, the thing's selling like hotcakes. You can get copies on, I think it's like $20, $24 on Amazon. But hey, here's a chance to get a free copy. So I'm giving one away every 10 days. The first raffle started a few days ago. You can get your name and your number in the raffle. Again, send it to cliff@earthancients.com, and we'll put it in. I'll announce the winner. Let's see. Today is the 23rd. I'll announce the winner on the, I started at 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. I'll announce the winner next Saturday, next show, which is the 30th. And then I'll do another one after that. So, because I got a couple extra copies. It's a great book. I'm only halfway through it. Quite a bit about cataclysm, the Dryas, the younger Dryas cataclysm that wiped out the surface of the planet over 10,000 years ago, details of the global destruction, not only the flood, but what it did, what this damage did to the Earth, and probably, what it did to whoever was on the planet at that time, basically wiped out any living beings, be it animal, man, or plants. And it's a great book. It's a good book to have in your library, and you can get a copy. Just send me your information, and you may be one of the people to get a copy of that. Okay, I think that is it for announcements. I'm going to play this now. The guest today is Wilhelm Wittgenstein. And the book is The Great Pyramid of Giza, A Modern View on Ancient Knowledge. And I will come back after the interview, and you can we'll talk a little bit about what's happening in the next week's show. So my guest today is Wilhelm Wittgenstein, and he has written a fascinating book called The Great Pyramid of Giza, A Modern View of Ancient Knowledge. And he sent me an article that I thought was fascinating, and we're going to talk about what he's discovered and his hypothesis as to what he believes the Great Pyramid was actually used for. William, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Cliff. First of all, I would like to thank you for the invitation to be on your show, and I'm really honored to be amongst the now impressive list of speakers who were a guest on previous shows.
Oh, well, hey, it's great to have you. From what I've seen here, you have really touched on some interesting aspects of the pyramid that I think a lot of people have thought about and maybe discussed briefly, but I think you take it to a different level. Talk to me about what is intriguing about the Great Pyramid for you. What was the what was it that triggered your thoughts of this of your theory behind the actual function of the pyramid?
Well, some years ago, I always was interested in the aspect of sound and old monuments, and I was triggered by an Egyptian wisdom keeper called Abd el-Hakim Awayan he lived in Giza, and he always said it is all about sound. And that really triggered my research, because I was already convinced that sound played an important role in monuments and especially in pyramids. And especially in the Great Pyramid, sound is very, very important. So that triggered a lot. And after researching sound, it was an easy step to the other elements, the earthly elements, the earth, water, air, and fire. Mm-hmm. And these four elements reflect the visible surfaces of the pyramid, not only the Great Pyramid, but every pyramid. Every pyramid in Egypt, or I think maybe all over the world, reflect the four earthly elements, the four visible elements, and the fifth invisible element is the crown surface of a pyramid. And that is the element ether. And these elements, the ratio in surface areas between the visible elements of the visible surfaces and the invisible surface is exactly the golden ratio number of 1.618. And that really triggered me, but especially the sound, the resonance inside the King's Chamber, what I call the resonance chamber in my book. That was really mind-blowing.
Okay. And this is interesting. I don't think anyone has discussed what you are presenting in your book, that the people who built this Great Pyramid were tapping into the earth elements, earth, wind, fire, and water.
That's right.
And when did you come to the conclusion that these elements were a part of the design and construction of the Great Pyramid? Were you walking through it and you had an aha moment where it was like, wait a minute, this pyramid, this is a machine, or this is a piece of construction that actually taps into the resources of the earth? What was the aha moment?
It was an aha moment, because besides sound, water and air and fire were also very important. Pyramid in ancient Greek was called pyramidos. That means fire in the middle, and that is the element fire. And that has to do with the process in the King's Chamber and the Reaction Chamber. The Reaction Chamber is the Queen's Chamber. And each element, each earthly element, represents a sustainable process inside the Great Pyramid. So it starts with the element Earth, that is the location where the pyramid is. It is one with the Earth. When you kick against the Giza Plateau, there is a vibration inside the pyramid. The second element, water, that is has to do with the Great Sphinx and the flooding of the Nile each year. They welcomed the water, and water was a raw material for the process inside the Great Pyramid. Air is the sound in the King's Chamber, the resonance inside the King's Chamber, and fire is the process, the final process of breaking water inside the resonance chamber. And that all together made me think it was surely meant to be a generator, a factory, and a process generator based upon the four earthly elements.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So before we get into what you discovered, I want to ask you probably a difficult question to answer, but I'm still going to ask you. Based on your analysis of this, the Great Pyramid, what would you say the people were? What would you say their level of sophistication was? And would you say they are pre-dynastic Egyptians that built the Great Pyramid? Or would you say that these are humanoids that were of a high level of not only advanced mathematics and engineering skill, but may have been from a different civilization on Earth that was wiped out? What do you say about that? I'm interested in knowing what you believe is the brains behind this machine.
Yeah, I am also giving lectures about the Great Pyramid, and then I always say the first dynasty of the ancient Egyptians was about 3500 BC, mm-hmm. and I calculated, or I discovered, just like other researchers, that the pyramids and the Sphinx are much older. They're more like 12,000 years old. Mm-hmm. And so there is a gap of about 7,000 years. But I always say, I call them ancient Egyptians as well, because I don't know how to call them and who they were. But as you say, they had a very high level of technology, and I'm sure we now today couldn't build the Great Pyramid as she is mm-hmm. now standing there on the plateau of Gizeh.
Okay. So in your years of research, in your study of the systems that are built into the Great Pyramid, you have found no references, documents, or evidence that gives you a clue about who built this.
No.
Okay.
No.
So the reason I ask that is that there's a tremendous amount of, there's ancient aliens, and ancient aliens gets into the fact that because we don't know what something is or who built it, it automatically must be from the aliens. And I have a huge problem with that, because I believe that Earthman has had cycles of culture where they were able to develop high levels of technology, and then they were destroyed either through cataclysm or self-destruction through bombs or weapons and of mass destruction or whatever. So when I ask you to give us a hint, you just kind of said now that you believe it, the construction was 10,000 plus years ago, which we don't really have any documents for. According to our current science, we would be hunters and gatherers at that time frame. So the pyramid in its current size and shape is almost indestructible. So it could weather either a man-made destruction or, which is, the latest discussions are this younger Dryas period, where there was a possible asteroid hit that caused a catastrophic terminating event that basically wiped most of the humans and animals and foliage off the planet. So that's about as far as you can go with it then. Is that true? Is that what you're saying? You really don't know?
No. I always say I'm not into aliens as well. And the ancient Egyptians and civilizations before that, they worked with another different time reckoning, and that was cyclical time and not linear time. And that is very hard to understand what cyclical time exactly is. Three famous scientists like Albert Einstein, Richard Feynman, and Stephen Hawking always said that past, present, and future exist simultaneously. And nobody ever knew what they really meant. But if that's true, what they say, or if it's true for a little bit, you can say that we are the builders of the Great Pyramid, only in the future tense. And that is the most difficult subject to explain to people, that we don't live on a line, we live on a circle. So on every part of that circle, these three stages exist. And when you live on a line, you have the past, the present, and the future, and you're on the way to the future. But when you live in a cyclical time aspect, you are in three time periods at the same time. And that's what the ancient Egyptians also believed, and no Egyptologist can explain to you what they really mean by that.
Okay. Have you heard of the yugas, the Hindu yugas, which is a cyclical system of time periods? It goes back millions and millions of years, and those who use it believe that modern humans, Homo sapiens sapiens, have been around for millions of years, and that they have started, stopped, developed, had high culture, and then were eliminated either through, like I said, natural calamities or through self-destruction. So have you heard about that?
Yeah, I heard about that, and I think there is some truth in that, because in many ancient civilizations, they use the cyclical time aspect and not linear time. So okay. I think the builders of the pyramids and the pyramids in Egypt especially is done by humans and not aliens.
Yeah. Just before we leave the subject, it's amazing because this is a work of brilliant engineering. The Great Pyramid of Giza not only is extremely tall. Most of the building blocks weigh a couple of tons each, and had to be lifted to great heights to complete it. When you go inside this pyramid, this machine, many of the stones are cut with extreme precision, fitted without mortar or any kind of bonding agent. It's just a work of real genius. It's like mind-blowing to think that somebody would sit down and hammer this out. Most technology has an R&D, a research and development period, where the height of technology had a starting point. And it's funny because when you look at the level of sophistication on that thing, it's like, where else in the world do you see examples of the Great Pyramid? I mean, just the construction alone. You see it on the Giza Plateau with smaller pyramids, and there's, 16 pyramids on the plateau. But where else in the world do we see examples of this that would show us that this was, you know, the final grand expression of this technology?
Yeah, that's true. And now, as you know, there are some beautiful and sophisticated pyramids in Middle America. But
yeah.
I think the Great Pyramid of Giza, and that is also because it's still very complete, the inside, is one of the best examples of high technology. And it is incredible. It's really a library of knowledge, but it is also about knowledge that we are not aware of. I mean, there is physics. They used physics inside the Great Pyramid that a professor on a university in Holland here said it is not possible. We don't know that kind of physics, it doesn't exist, but it is there. Mm. It is there, all right, and they used it.
Wow.
We first have to accept that the builders of the Great Pyramid and the other pyramids in Egypt, we first have to accept that they used a different kind of knowledge and that we can learn from that, mm-hmm. and not expect that everything that is behind us in the past that is on a lower level than we are now. That is a big mistake.
Yeah, it's interesting. The book is The Great Pyramid of Giza, and we're going to talk a little bit now about what you've discovered, which I find is fascinating. The first thing I want to talk about is the tunnel system that you've discovered. Now, a lot of past investigators have found a tunnel system, but you believe that the tunnel system was there not only to channel and move water, but also to feed the Great Pyramid. And what most people don't understand about the plateau where the Great Pyramid sits is they're only looking at part of this machine, which is the upper earth and sky pyramid-shaped structures, but underneath them on this plateau of limestone are precision-cut tunnels. Can you tell us a little bit about those tunnels and how in-depth they are?
Yeah, these tunnels, the main thing, and that you already said that these tunnels were for the transportation of water, because the pyramids used water. They were pumping up water in a natural way. And the entrance for the water, that was the Sphinx Temple, because before the Aswan Dam was built, the Nile River flooded each year, and the water came up to the front paws of the Sphinx. That's what everybody knows. That is not so long ago. Mm-hmm. And the Sphinx is placed in a moat, in a Sphinx moat, and was suitable for water. But it first had to pass through the Sphinx Temple in front of the Sphinx. It was the water was purified in that Sphinx Temple. Hmm. And before and after it was purified, it came into the Sphinx moat, where you have some wells alongside the body of the Sphinx. The Sphinx was a lion, not a pharaoh. It was just a lion looking at the east, where the constellation of Leo rose, 10,500 BC. And the water was going down. Edgar Cayce always said the Hall of Records, where all kinds of important documents of the ancient Egyptians were buried, is under the front porch of the Sphinx. But I don't believe that. There is a chamber underneath the Sphinx that was filled with water. Mm-hmm. From the wells inside the Sphinx moat, it went down. And from that position, it went further to the Campbell's tomb, that is about 60, 70 meters behind the Sphinx, and further to the Osiris shaft, what they call the Osiris shaft, and from there to the underground chamber in the Great Pyramid. Okay. It was a natural system, and you can compare it with a toy that some kids use. That is, they make they call it a Heron's fountain. They use two bottles. With the pressure in the bottles, you can pump up water in a natural way, and that is what they did. Mm-hmm. They used the water from the Nile, and it was pumped up by water pressure from Saqqara.
Right. Now, you talk about the Heron's Fountain, and you actually show a description in an article I just read that you wrote, and I think this is in the book, too. Now, what's unique about what you're saying is that we observe these megalithic structures, the Great Sphinx, the causeway, the Sphinx enclosure, and the temple, as well as the Great Pyramid. These are beautiful to see on the outside, but basically they're covering up the machine works that power this pyramid. Is that what you're trying to say?
Yeah, if you look down a shaft on the Giza Plateau, and there are lots of shafts that are open, and you can look in, you see tunnels going sideways, and from the Osiris shaft that is under that causeway you mentioned, there is a tunnel going directly to the underground chamber inside the Great Pyramid. Mm-hmm. So that was the way the water followed. And because not only Giza, but also Saqqara, the Saqqara Pyramid Complex, was also connected underground to the Giza Plateau. So the flooding of the Nile in Saqqara was also used to feed the pyramids downstream. That was all in the process of the Heron's Fountain, to build up pressure and to push the water, the Nile water, into the Great Pyramid.
Okay. So if, as you say, the Sphinx, the underground causeways, the tunnel system that leads to the Great Pyramid were all part of this pumping waterway, to feed this great machine, the question I have to ask you is, why build such a monstrosity of a pyramid to house the inner workings? Was it necessary to build it so high, or did it have, in your belief, more functions than just the machine that we'll talk about in a minute, what the machine did and how it worked? But why would you say the reason would be to build? I mean, this thing is huge, massive. You know, it's the biggest stone structure in the world. It's the megalith of all megaliths. Why build it so high?
Yeah, that's a good question. But I believe they build it that high and that big because it had to withstand time. They are trying to tell us something. They're not just telling us this is a machine producing this or that. No, it is a letter. It is a letter in stone from a lost ancient civilization. Mm. And they're trying to tell us how we should deal with the natural sources of the earth. So it had to withstand 10, 20,000 years and be in good shape so we could read, so we can read this letter. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot to read. I mean, every science field is present inside the Great Pyramid. It is about sound, it is about medicine, healing, sound resonance, it's chemistry, it is all built in. It's really some kind of letter. Mm. And it had to be withstanding, it had to withstand earthquakes and floods and everything what you can think of, mm-hmm. just to tell us this important message.
Okay. You know, it's funny that you mention that because you call the Great Pyramid a knowledge center, and I'm curious about that. If it, what part of the pyramid contains the knowledge, or is it the entire system is the knowledge system? What are you referring to when you make that statement?
It is the entire system. When you go inside, and you have to realize that the pyramid was never accessible. It was a fully closed system. It was never meant to be accessible for humans. There is no entrance. We say there is an entrance on the north side, where you enter the pyramid a little bit, about 10, 15 meters above the Gap El Mamoun made, mm-hmm. there is the official entrance. But there is no entrance. That is an exit. There is only one exit, and that is an exit for water. There is no real entrance. But when you enter the pyramid, everything is coming back in our modern sciences. That is sound, and that is frequencies. And you must, if you take the outside of the pyramid, I mean, the mathematical constants are built in, like pi and phi, and also the speed of light is built in three ways in the pyramid structure, just to show that they knew about the speed of light as we defined it in 1983. That's the metric system. They already knew about our metric system. They're giving us the speed of light on 8 decimals. And that is incredible.
Wow.
Everything is built in and explained or expressed in three different ways. Mm-hmm. So you're not overlooking something.
You describe the date as of construction as 10,472 BC for the construction of the entire complex. And then we've had other authors describe this, and there's a number of books that talk about it. Astrologically, the period that would adhere to would be the astrological, the lion would be the focal point on that. I think also Robert Bovall speaks of the same thing. The Sphinx is facing a certain astrological alignment, and when you do a computer analysis and you go back to that time period, it actually, you can, the lion would be looking at a certain constellation, the constellation of Leo. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct, and that is where Leo rose on the horizon.
Mm-hmm.
And that is that the, only the Sphinx that, that points us to the age of Leo is only the bandwidth in which we have to search for a certain date. And Bovall did that with the Orion's belt. That is one way to look at it. I have a different opinion on that.
Mm-hmm.
I say the three large pyramids of Giza are a projection of the three inner planets. And these are Earth, Venus, and Mercury. And when you, together with the era of the lion that is represented by the Sphinx, you have to find out when in that bandwidth of the leap of the age of Leo did the three inner planets were positioned mutually like the three pyramids are now. And then you come to a date and you have software programs for that, like Stellarium or SkyGlobe. And then you can exactly point out when they had this position. And that was 10,472 years before Christ. But you need the Sphinx, because during the 10,000 years, there were many opportunities that these planets, these three inner planets, had the same position as they have now. But you needed the Sphinx to pinpoint the right year.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So let's go inside the Great Pyramid, this machine that was built, 12,000 years ago, 10,472 BC, which would be over 12,000 years. What is it that's unique about the interior that begins to, in your mind, show the evidence of some kind of chemical reaction or system that it makes it a machine?
Before I go there, Cliff, in Holland, in the Netherlands, in the north of Holland, we have a new project, a new radio astronomy project, and that is called LOFAR. That means low frequency array. I always said the pyramid, the Giza pyramid, and all the other pyramids function as an antenna. They receive a certain frequency, they amplify that, and they use the resonance of that frequency with the water to break water. But now I have the evidence that the pyramid is really an antenna, because that new project that is since 2012, they found out, they realized that a certain antenna is capable of receiving low frequency electromagnetic energy. And these antennas, they are thousands of them. They are spread out over Holland, but also Germany and Great Britain and Poland, and so they were all connected to each other to make one large antenna. But they have the same ratio as the Great Pyramid, only smaller. So they receive a frequency of around 90 megahertz. The higher you build this antenna, the lower the frequency is that you can receive. And the Great Pyramid was built to receive the so-called Earth frequency, or Schumann resonance frequency, of around 7.5 hertz, 8 hertz.
Mm-hmm.
And there were some guys, they were measuring around the pyramids and inside the pyramids, and they found a dominating frequency of around 8 hertz. And they just used the Earth frequency, the Schumann frequency, to receive and to amplify it in the antechamber, leading to the king's chamber, to the resonance chamber. And in the resonance chamber, you have a frequency of 16.2 hertz, because 8.1 hertz is exactly the Schumann frequency for the latitude of Giza. So it was an antenna for receiving a frequency belonging to the Earth. They didn't make a frequency, they just received it.
So do you think the shape of the pyramid itself was some kind of receiving station?
The shape of the pyramid, and that's what I'm telling you about the antennas, of that these new radio astronomy antennas, they have the shape of pyramids.
Wow.
It's a huge project, and there is a new project starting in South Africa and Australia that is called the SKA project, the Square Kilometer Array. And these are also thousands of small antennas, and in exactly the shape of the Great Pyramid. But they don't know that they had built antennas like the Great Pyramid. They just found out that this shape is perfect for receiving low frequency waves.
Fascinating.
They want to know when the Big Bang was. So they want to make pictures of the universe with these antennas as close as possible to the date of the Big Bang, so around 13.7 billion years ago.
So let me understand this. It's your discovery and those of other scientists that this pyramid shape actually absorbs the frequency of the Earth, which is, I guess, a natural frequency, and pulls it into the inner chambers where there's other elements in place to work with. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying, and that's what why the Grand Gallery is of importance, and Christopher Dunn already dealt with that. He said there were Helmholtz resonators inside the Grand Gallery, and another theory is about crystal, quartz crystal, because quartz has the capability of stabilizing frequencies, and I think that's true. There were some kind of crystals inside the Grand Gallery to stabilize the Earth frequency. Because in very old-fashioned radios, you also used a crystal to stabilize the frequency.
Yeah. You've mentioned that before in your writing. You believe that in the Grand Gallery there were some crystal resonators that were either positioned in such a way or something that you believe would amplify these natural emissions power, begin to really power the whole process. Is that what you believe?
Yeah, it was not really amplifying yet, because amplifying was done in the chamber between the Grand Gallery and the resonance chamber, the King's Chamber. That's what I call the antechamber. And the antechamber was equipped with granite slabs. And when you take a look at the antechamber, it is like an old-fashioned loudspeaker box on the inside. You force sound to travel a longer way. And by doing that, you amplify sound in a natural way. That's exactly the same principle in a modern loudspeaker. Mm-hmm. So there was an amplified sound package of sound coming into the resonance chamber, King's Chamber. And the King's Chamber was built to receive only one frequency, and the rest is dying out. And the one frequency it's built for, that was capable of resonating and producing a standing wave inside the King's Chamber.
Okay. Did you find evidence of supports for these crystal resonators or dishes or whatever that were in the pyramid?
No, they're not mentioned anywhere. No documents, no proof, no debris of crystals or whatever. Mm-hmm. So it could also easily be that there were large phases, like a granite phases inside the Grand Gallery, mm-hmm. Grand Gallery to use as Helmholtz resonators to produce the sound, because you had an airflow to the King's Chamber, so you could use the airflow to produce sound in whatever frequency you like. So that is another possibility. But I believe there were crystals inside, but it was dismantled already many, many thousand years ago. So.
Okay. It's interesting that you talk about crystals as a form of a natural resonator, but have you analyzed the kind of granite that's used? Because there's all types of interesting stone selection in that inner chamber where there's a lot of activity. Did you have a sense of what different kinds of granites were used, or does that make a difference?
Yeah, that makes a difference, because in the King's Chamber is built of S1 granite, that is the red granite. And this granite has a lot of quartz crystals inside, so mm-hmm. large amount of this granite is quartz. And when you're producing resonance inside this chamber, what you do is you make some kind of mechanical pressure because of the resonance, and then you get a kind of piezoelectric effect from physics that is transforming mechanical pressure by resonance in that chamber into electricity and vice versa. You generate an electric charge in response to applied mechanical stress, and that stress is the extreme resonance that was produced by this chamber.
Interesting. Okay, so let's follow the path of the water. So this monstrous system was built. We don't know how long it took, over 10,000 years ago. And as the water is pumped up from the Nile, it passes underneath the Sphinx up a corridor and enters into the base of the pyramid. Then where does the water go after that?
It was pushed. There was a lot of pressure. There was a lot of pressure behind that water. So it was pushed out through the ascending or descending passage. And halfway the descending passage, where you have the ascending passage going up, there was a prism stone. And it was a kind of stone that was pushed open by the water. And when you stop the water transport, it will fall down and locks everything. Mm-hmm. That's what they did. And they produced a very large, very strong vacuum above the water. And what happens when you have a vacuum over a water level? The water starts to boil without heat, without fire, without anything. It's just a natural way of boiling. And boiling water produces water vapor. So the pyramid was filling up with water vapor up to the King's Chamber. Everything was filled with water chamber. And together with the sound it produced, that is a very difficult part in physics, because I contacted a professor here at the university, and he said there is no other way of breaking water than electrolysis of water, that is with electricity or with very aggressive chemicals. But there is one other way, and there was a physicist or a medical doctor here in Holland, living in Holland, and his name was Andrea Puharic, and he discovered that you could break water molecules into hydrogen and oxygen by a very strong sound resonance. And that triggered me, and that is what happened. Because of the strong sound resonance, you could break the water into hydrogen and oxygen. That was the important key.
Okay. Do you think, looking at the inner structure that you have analyzed, that there were some human elements, participation involved, where somebody needed to keep an eye on what was going on inside there and pull a lever to lift a gate, or do you think it was completely automated?
Yeah, it was completely automated because it had to be closed. It had to be a fully closed system. Only you had to enter the pyramid, and that was possible when it was shut down. You could enter the pyramid for repairs or whatever. Mm-hmm. And that's where the sarcophagus is important, because in the resonance chamber, you had the standing wave of the sound resonance. And a standing wave means that in the middle, exactly in the middle of the resonance chamber, you had the maximum sound energy. And on that place was the sarcophagus. The sarcophagus was also standing on small pebbles for resonation. And by the sarcophagus, you could tune the complete resonance chamber when something happened, or the exact frequency was changed or whatever. By lying inside the resonance in that sarcophagus or resonance box, you could produce a sound, and that resonance box is built for a resonance frequency of 81 hertz. That is about the human male voice. So you could keep the resonance box resonating, and by resonating the resonance box, the whole resonance chamber started to resonate, because 81 hertz was exactly the fifth harmonic of the resonance frequency of the King's Chamber. So you could see that as a sort of kind of control system to see if the frequency inside the chamber was still right. When it wasn't, you couldn't. There you have five chambers above the King's Chamber, and you could enter there and take some material away from these blocks to tune the whole system again to the right frequency.
Okay. Did you do any measurements when you were in the King's Chamber or any other part of the pyramid, the interior pyramid, to determine that there was a standing frequency that was built for that? I mean, it was generated from whatever happened in there, or...
It's very hard to take measurements, but the best way to see if the resonance chamber is starting to resonate on a certain frequency is by using your own voice in a very low frequency, because in your voice there is always the frequency that suits this chamber.
Right.
It's an incredible effect. When you stand in the middle of the King's Chamber, you make a very low sound, it will be picked up by the chamber, and the whole chamber and the resonance tower with the five chambers above will start to resonate. That is a very easy way to check if there is a standing wave because of the resonance inside this chamber.
No, that's funny you mention that, because I know and have read about other musicians and people who are singing or going into meditation, that when they hum or they play a certain key, it resonates throughout that room, and actually can intensify, or it does really strange things, and people go in there to do meditations because it seems to be tuned in such a way that it really either reflects or intensifies sound.
Yeah, it's like the King's Chamber is built to produce that standing wave, to produce the resonance. And that is a specific frequency of 16.2 hertz. And that is what I call in my book the golden frequency of Giza, because that number is exactly the same as the golden ratio number of 1.618. Only the decimal point is one place to the right, and it is rounded to one decimal. But it is exactly the same number. It is 16.2 hertz. And that is the frequency on which the whole chamber resonates. And it is an incredible effect. It is really incredible.
Now, was water carried into the king's chamber?
No, that was the water vapor that was coming from below because of the vacuum. The water started to boil. So all chambers and tunnels and shafts were filled up with the water vapor.
Hmm.
So water vapor, that is nothing else than normal water, was broken by the strong resonance in hydrogen and oxygen. And you say, well, that's strange, that the hydrogen, but there is one part in the evidence that there was hydrogen inside the king's chamber, and that is a northern shaft, what they call the ventilation shaft, the shaft pointing to certain constellations, or the shaft for the soul of the deceased pharaoh. But that shaft is nothing else than is nothing but a waveguide for a certain wavelength, and that is exactly the same as a waveguide they use in modern radar equipment. That radar, you have 3 and 10 centimeter radar installations, because I worked with it for a long time as a navigation officer. So I found out that the measurement of the northern shaft is the same as a waveguide for a radar installation, only for a different wavelength. Inside the king's chamber, this is the wavelength of 21 centimeters, and that is the wavelength of hydrogen.
Okay, so you have sound, air, you have water, vapor into the room. And where was the chemical reaction? Was it in the king's chamber that it created energy, or where was the reaction?
The water was broken inside the king's chamber, so the whole system was filling up with a mixture of oxygen and hydrogen. So 1 liter, one liter of water will be 1 cubic meter of hydrogen gas. That is extremely high pressure. So the whole of the pyramid was now filling up with hydrogen gas and oxygen. So also the queen's chamber, and that is what I call the reaction chamber. There are inside the queen's chamber, there are 2 shafts going up but not going out. They are blocked by a door with 2 copper handles.
Yes.
And that is where the reaction took place, because these shafts were filled up with a mixture of hydrogen and oxygen, and what you can see that they had built a perfect fuel cell, because it is a reversed electrolysis of water. What you do is you transport 2 gases, oxygen and hydrogen, to 2 electrodes. One is an anode and one is a cathode, and you produce electricity. It is a fuel cell without a membrane and with the use of an electrolyte. And that reaction chamber, that queen's chamber, was covered with salt. And salt and water is the best electrolyte you can have. Just normal salt and water. So the reaction chamber with the 2 shafts leading up is nothing but a fuel cell, 2 fuel cells.
Okay, and how did, what was the reaction? So it exploded somewhere?
No, it didn't explode, but you create an electric current. That's what you do. And from these blocked shafts at the end, there were, that is what I expect, there were lines or copper wires leading up to the near the top of the Great Pyramid, to a certain chamber. So that's what I did. They produced fuel. They produced fuel in the form of hydrogen gas,
mm-hmm.
and they produced electricity. Okay. And the next question is, what did they do with the electricity?
Well, I think my next question was, where did you follow a path of where maybe there was a battery or something that stored the electricity, or was it just, do you believe it was just sent out to the local areas to be used as needed?
From the ends of these reaction shafts, there are copper wires or copper cables going up to the top platform of the Great Pyramid, but not really to the platform, but to a chamber a little bit lower than the top platform. And they still have to discover this chamber. And what you say, batteries, that is, in my opinion, some kind of generator room where they stored electricity. And that's what I call the chamber of records. And I hope that they will find something by scanning the pyramids. They are now scanning the pyramids, looking for void spaces and all. And I hope they will find this chamber, because I'm certain this chamber is in the position I discussed in my book. And that is from many sources. I have information about this chamber from Strabo, a Greek historian, but also from Edward Litskalnin, that built Coral Castle in Homestead, Florida. He knew about the position of these chambers.
Really?
He triggered me. I went there in the beginning of 2015, so in February, March, and I wanted to see, because I already knew that he was giving me the coordinates of this chamber.
Right.
The numbers on his immigration certificate are the exact coordinates of the chamber near the top of the Great Pyramid. Hmm. And that's incredible.
Yeah.
There are a lot of clues, a lot of clues in his Coral Castle, that park, that is about the Great Pyramid and the King's Chamber.
Yeah, it is interesting. Let's go back to the interior of the Great Pyramid. You believe that above the King and Queen's Chamber is another room which you have basically said it has a generator of some kind in it. Do you think that generator is a machine of some kind? Or are we talking somehow imbuing stone with the results of energy? I would think it would have to be some kind of a machine, wouldn't it?
A machine, or just like you have the Baghdad battery, just to store electricity and use it in underground crypts and tunnels. That is also a possibility. But I believe and there is much more in this chamber. If you want to find secrets about the builders or the building methods of the pyramids, I think you can find a lot there. There is much more than only storing electricity. This is not the hall of records, but I believe the chamber of records. Mm-hmm. Everything points towards that chamber. Okay. Whatever you calculate, and even the resonance frequency of 16.2 hertz in the resonance chamber is used as a number to give the position of that chamber in the top.
Interesting. So rather than being below, you believe that this chamber of records, which is housing this generator to store the energy, is above maybe in the last third of the pyramid, the top.
Yes,
yeah.
I know exactly where it is. When I climb up the pyramid, I can show you where it is. I don't know where the entrance is yet, but I know where the chamber is. But they won't let me, of course.
Yeah, they don't let anybody get up there. Is there any of these shafts that are inside the pyramid that go open to open an area? Is there any shaft that leads to
There are two shafts from the King's Chamber. One is going, these two are going outside.
Right.
And one was blocked on the inside by a thin granite slab or plate.
Yeah.
To prevent oxygen and hydrogen to go outside the pyramid. Mm-hmm. And the southern shaft was shaped like a kind of organ pipe. That southern shaft made a sound. if you take Herodotus, the Greek historian, always said that you could hear the pyramid hum over a very large distance. That was the sound of the pyramid through the southern shaft from the king's chamber. That was always blowing, and that had a certain tone. That there was some kind of control tone, because when the pitch changed, you knew that the pressure inside the king's chamber changed. And that could be very dangerous. So they had to find a way to release the pressure inside the king's chamber. And they did that with the northern shaft. The only thing they found inside the Great Pyramid when they entered it, that were no treasures and no gold treasures, but it was a granite small ball. And that ball exactly fits in the northern shaft of the king's chamber. Huh. From the outside, you could let go that ball, and it was opening the shaft, so the overpressure could be released by the northern shaft.
That's amazing. So, boy, that would be an eye opener if they do a scan and they find a chamber in the upper third of the pyramid, and they look a little closer, and I don't know how the heck they'd have to take part of the top of the pyramid off to get in there.
No, there is an entrance at that level, because there is also at a certain level entrance to the ends of the shafts going up from the reaction chamber, from the queen's chamber, because sometimes you had to repair something. So there must be one or two blocks at that certain level which are movable.
Okay. From the outside going in, or from inside going out?
No, from the outside going in.
Okay.
And I'm not sure yet on which side it is. I suspect it's on the eastern side, but I'm not sure. But on that certain level, there must be an entrance to this chamber from the outside.
Fascinating. Okay, so here we have this energy generator generating electricity. What is this the only pyramid on the plateau that you believe is a generator, or are there other? I mean, because there's big pyramids everywhere, not as big as the Great Pyramid. But what about these other pyramids? I can't remember the name of the one that's close by, but their interiors use these megalithic stones. Were those also resonators, or were they used for something else?
All the pyramids have some kind of resonator room, resonating chamber. Mm-hmm. And all the pyramids in all of Egypt are meant to pump up water. They have all underground tunnels, and they were all connected to the Nile River. Mm-hmm. So they were all pumping up water, and they all have chambers shaped like the Grand Gallery in the Great Pyramid, and the shape is telling us that they used sound, so they used resonance. But the Great Pyramid is in the best shape of all. So there are a lot of pyramids that are ruined inside, so it's very hard to tell if they have the same function. Mm-hmm. They also could have been used as storage, but it's not certain.
Okay.
The Great Pyramid is the best, is in the best shape, so it's...
Okay, so this is fascinating. It's funny because Chris Dunn, I don't think it's been 15 years or more, wrote a book called Giza Power Plant, and where he describes a similar type of reaction, and he excuse me, shows evidence of extracts from on the wall, salt extracts and other extracts that would be the reaction from chemical reactions, would be the deposits from chemical reactions. Do you have the same belief that he does? The same.
I didn't read all of his work. I'm a great admirer of his work, but I'm not sure if they used very aggressive chemicals. I believe their goal was to tell us how to produce energy in a clean way, in a very sustainable way. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not sure about the chemicals, but it could also be from later in time, because there are so many layers in Egypt, and you have to dig and come to the first layer to find out what's important. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure about using chemicals to produce hydrogen, but it is one of the possibilities. But I believe, strongly believe, that a sound resonance was used to break water and to produce hydrogen, oxygen, and electricity. And I believe that that is what they're trying to tell us, that you should use that implosion technology instead of explosion technology.
Right. What are they going to use electricity for? I mean, this is the brilliance of what Chris Dunn talks about. And for those of you listening who don't know Chris Dunn, he wrote the Giza Power Plant probably 20 years ago. And then his more recent books, he takes a look at the great sculptures of the Ramses II, I believe, who's a few, I think it's like, I want to say 3,000 years ago or 2,500 years ago. Can't remember exactly. But what's unique about his analysis as a tool die engineer, somebody who crafts highly sophisticated tools and parts for NASA machines and rockets and stuff? He believes, and he shows without a doubt, that a lot of these sculptures were cut using templates and machines, and they were die cut with such precision that no two sculptures of Ramses are that different. They look all the same, and they're cut with levels of precision that only can be achieved using technology. So my question to you is, what were they using this electricity for? What in your thinking, what would they be doing with it? Because I don't know if they've found any evidence of machines at this point. I mean, we could be blinded by some of these amazingly well-cut stone artifacts that could carry electricity. But what do you think they were doing?
Yeah, I'm not really sure, because the Great Pyramid producing electricity, that is not in a very large amount. So they could have used electricity indeed to use for power tools, because they didn't use hammers and copper chisels to make these structures and to make these images of what you say Ramses II, that is of such a precision, and that goes for the beams inside the Great Pyramid, the ceiling beams of the King's Chamber are exactly level, and they weigh 70 tons each. That is incredible, and they couldn't have done that with a normal crane. As a ship's officer, we transported lots of times large stones weighing about 50, 60 tons, marble from Italy. And that was a huge, huge operation in this time. So let alone in 10,000 BC, what they used for lifting stones and transporting stones. That is incredible. So they must have had some kind of tools, power tools, to do the job. And maybe they use the electricity that was produced in a pyramid like the Great Pyramid. But I'm not sure, because what I believe is that these builders, these people, this civilization is telling us how to produce electricity in a good way that is not damaging the earth. It is what I told you, it is a letter to us, how to be kind to our planet. Not destroy it by what we're doing now. There are other ways to produce electricity and fuel. That's what the main reason was.
Expand on that a little bit, what you believe that this great pyramid is a letter. And you're kind of telling us right now that it's like, okay, this is an easy, natural way to produce electricity without, you know, coal digging out and polluting our atmosphere, or radioactive rods placed in a reactor to produce electricity, and then poisoning those who are close to it and killing people because of the deadly radiation. But what else can you tell us? Well, keep going about this, what your belief is about this message.
Now, this message is about a sustainable use of our own Earth resources. And that's what I meant by the Earth frequency and the water, to purify water. I mean, like they did, they purified water by harmonic movement of water. And now we discover that we can purify and clean water by this same movement. There are factories in Sweden already. They are cleaning wastewater in that same way the ancient Egyptians did. And then the water is going back into the fjord. And that is very remarkable. And it's the same for sound. That they wrote us a letter in stone. And we have to take them seriously, because every part, every piece of science that we know of is built in this structure on every level. I mean, we now rediscover sound as a meaning, as a mean to heal people, to resonate, the resonation of body cells, to bring them back to their original pure state. And that's what we did. That's what the ancients did with water molecules. Resonation brings them back in their pure original state. That it, there are all lessons how to treat our Earth and how to be careful with the Earth resources and not destroying it. I think it's a very important message.
Go ahead.
And that's why we have to take them seriously, because everything is built in. So the sender of the letter is really convincing us of the importance of that. That's what I believe is happening.
Okay. So, in our few last minutes, what do you want the reader to get from your book? I mean, you've talked about what you've discovered, but what is your feeling, and what's your goal for the reader?
My important goal for the reader is that they I'm not just selling my book. I'm selling a story. And I hope that by this story, people wake up and that they don't accept any stories told to them by the authorities or whatever. I mean, the Egyptian authorities, Egyptologists, archaeologists are still telling people visiting the Great Pyramid that it is built in 20 years. I mean, it's 2.6 million blocks of limestone weighing around 1 ton each. That means that you have to put a block in position, you have to cut, you have to transport and put in position in less than 3 minutes. That is impossible. And that is still the message of our scientists. And science is absolutely not a synonym for truth. So even researchers without a title, they may have brilliant ideas. They are just as important as scientists. They need each other. And what I want to achieve is that the readers will make up their own mind and not just believe what they are told. And that includes me. I hope that people will see for themselves, will look, will hear, and everything. That they make up their own mind, they follow their own path, and not just accept what they have been told. That is my main goal.
Fantastic. Now, this book won't be out for another couple of months, right? The 1st of March it's going to be released?
It's now at the printer, so I hope it will now, the second half of March, that it will be available in the States.
Okay, good. I will definitely promote it. So let's keep in touch. And what I'll do is I'll have you on the program to announce the release at the beginning of the show. We'll go ahead and do a little a quick interview with you to see if there's any new research you can talk about in launching this new book. How's that sound?
Yeah, that's very nice. And people can always contact me on through Facebook or via the website that is willemwitteveen.com.
Why don't you spell that out for us so they know? It's www.
And then my name, my first name and second name, .com.
Okay.
willemwitteveen.com.
Okay, and I'll post that this weekend with a photograph or two. Why don't you send me a couple of photographs from the book, if you would, if you have them, or a diagram that I can post as notes to your description, and then that'll kind of be
I will.
Of interest, so people can be looking forward to it in the coming weeks when it's released.
Willem,
thank you very much. Really appreciate the interview, and we're looking forward to seeing the book, and much great success to you.
Okay, thank you very much for the opportunity, and hope to meet you one day somewhere, right?
Okay,
somewhere
great.
Near pyramids or. But that's my last. I'm very nervous, not really nervous, but about the outcome of the scans. I hope they will find that void space, what I reckon to be the chamber of records.
Well, what's interesting is I've seen some of the images from these early scans, which is it's being produced by a consortium of scientists from Paris, France, Canada, and Egypt. And yeah. They've already found some very interesting blocks at the base of the pyramid that seem to be tuned or they're very light in weight, and there's maybe something behind them. Have you seen those scans?
Yeah. Yeah, I've seen those. And then they expect that there's a void space behind it or so.
Yeah.
But the chamber I'm talking about is at least is in the center line of the pyramid. So it's about 10.5 meters inside. I'm not sure if their scan will find them.
Right.
I can point it out to them if they like.
Should send them a letter. Boy, that's all we need to do. Love them to get up high and find that generator.
Yeah.
That'd be fantastic.
I'm 100% sure it's there. There are so many. I have so many clues about this chamber from the beginning, from before Christ, from Strabo, from so many people talking about. It's even on your $1 bill.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
Because the committee that designed the dollar bill many years ago, they used the book, a certain book about the pyramids. And your country said that it was an example for the United States. It was Egypt. So
yeah.
Nobody knows, but it is on your dollar bill as well.
That's kind of interesting. Okay, well, I got to jump. Thank you, sir, and appreciate your time.
Okay, thank you very much. I will send you some photographs of from the book, and then we talk again.
Yeah, we'll definitely talk again, and success. And, everybody on Facebook loves to talk about pyramids, so I'm sure you're going to have some other people wanting you to do interviews with them. So I think it's just the beginning.
Okay. Thank you very much, and a pleasant day.
Take care. So that was William Witteveen and the Great Pyramid of Giza, A Modern View of Ancient Knowledge. I have posted a graphic from the book. You can see it on Facebook, Earth Ancients, both international page and the group page. And you can see where he talks about the elements of Earth, how the pyramid was built to support the elements of Earth, wind, fire, water. And it's a diagram. So go to the Facebook page. You can see it there under his name. The interesting thing about the Sphinx, though, and when you look at the photographs I've posted, you can get an idea. It looks like a giant sieve because of these chambers, these openings around the perimeter
that have now been covered. But the openings show that, and I believe he's right in his article, and that reminds me, I think I'll also post the article that he sent to me. The perimeter shows that the sieve, the pump that's built into the Sphinx itself, drew water down into the interior and then was pumped up into the actual pyramid itself. And it's funny because we don't have the blueprints of the construction of the Sphinx or the pyramid, obviously. It would be wonderful to know. But I've seen this kind of thing happen in the reconstruction of pyramids in Central America, in Mexico, specifically the Yucatan Peninsula, where the archaeologists have consolidated stone that's laying around a pyramid, and they just go ahead and cover stuff up without really knowing about it. And it's a real shame that that they covered these shafts up, these openings in the base of the Sphinx, because obviously they were meant to be open. They were meant to be drains for the water. So we continue to learn more about the building of the Sphinx and the Great Pyramid, and the whole engine that is this pump, is this energy generator that Wilhelm talks to us about and reveals to us. And he mentioned it a little bit. They're actually scanning the exterior of the pyramid right now and revealing a lot of information. Now, hopefully they'll be able to pass through the upper sections of it. I don't know how they're going to do that. They're probably going to have to take a helicopter and scan the upper areas. And if that chamber is there, we'll know about it. Let's cross our fingers that we will be given the information, that it will be revealed to us, so that we'll know more about this fantastic bit of engineering known as the Great Pyramid. I hope you enjoyed today's show, and have a great week. Stay tuned for more shows. I haven't launched the Spotlight on Wednesdays yet, but I will be launching a crowdfunding program so we can increase the shows on the Earth Ancient Network. The Blog Talk Radio has given me the green light to go ahead and start developing additional programs, and you're going to be blown away by some of the guest hosts that are going to be on this program, the best of the best, and I can guarantee you will be delighted. But we need your support. We need your support to grow and build this network. So this crowdfunding program will be available, and I will be mentioning it as it's developed. Again, remember that you can get a copy of Graham Hancock's new bestseller, Magicians of the Gods, by sending me an email, cliff@earthancients.com, and just giving me your address, and then choose a number. Pick a number between 1 and 1,000. And send it to me in an email, cliff@earthancients.com. You'll get a free copy of, if you win the raffle, you'll get a free copy of this groundbreaking book. All right, that's it for today, and we will talk to you next week.